A Matter of Spirit is the quarterly justice journal of the Inner Community Peace and Justice Center. This article appeared in the winter 2019 issue to reform and transform the church. The Church, Spiritual Body and Human Institution by Father Terence J. Moran. Father Terence J. Moran is an associate of the Sisters of St. Joseph of Peace and the director of the Office of Peace, Justice, and Ecological Integrity of the Sisters of Charity of St. Elizabeth, Convent Station, New Jersey. The story is told of a group of American bishops making their ad limina visit to Rome in the 1980s, a visit which included, in addition to meetings with the Pope, sessions with the heads of the main Vatican offices. Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, then head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, emphatically lectured the bishops that the Church was not a democracy. One of the American bishops remarked, "If that were true, then maybe they should choose the next pope by not voting, but by picking names out of a hat and leaving the choice to God." The American bishop and the future Pope Benedict XVI each had a point. The Church, like any other human institution, is a political reality, but it is more than a political reality. The Church has lived within nearly every human political system conceivable and has influenced and been influenced by each of them. Our bishops dress like Renaissance and Byzantine courtiers. Catholic worker Brian Terrell notes the irony that at the Eucharist, the priest dresses like a functionary of the Roman Empire that killed Jesus. The Pope is an absolute monarch, yet the Church has canon law, which details the rights and duties of members and outlines due process. And many popes have discovered that their absolute authority often is challenged by the powerful inertia or resistance of the flock. Religious orders are outstandingly successful examples of each giving according to ability and receiving according to need. Whatever political systems the Church has adopted in its long history, it has always been administered by flawed human beings and, not infrequently, by gravely irresponsible ones. It's important to acknowledge as well that many of the values the Church now treasures as its own, such as the dignity of the human person and conscience, the existence of inviolable human rights, the equality of women, and an abhorrence for racism, slavery, and torture, all had their origins in secular political movements and were often initially vigorously opposed by Church authority. Where was the Spirit at work in the 19th century in the United States? In secular and non-Catholic groups that worked for the abolition of slavery, or in Catholic bishops and theologians who largely defended slavery as morally legitimate? Who was impelled by the Spirit in the clerical sex abuse crisis? Secular journalists who listened to and amplified the voices of the victims? Or the bishops who ignored and silenced victims and abetted and protected their abusers? The Church also shares with virtually every institution in human society deep roots in patriarchy. The accumulation of power in the hands of men and the valuing of men's power and interest over every other concern. We see the same behavior at moments of crisis in other patriarchal institutions, as we have seen in the hierarchy of the Church. Corporations, the police, the military, professional athletics, and academic institutions all tend to resist public inquiry into their inner workings, attempt to deal with abuses internally in ways that preserve the reputation of the institution, silence and marginalize dissident voices, and value institutional prestige over justice and equity. Of course, these behaviors are all the more repugnant and inexplicable when they come from those who profess to be the shepherds of God's flock. Dorothy Day, someone not unfamiliar with the corruption of the hierarchy, said, quote, "The gospel provides the Church with the seeds for its own renewal," unquote. I would suggest three seeds of renewal which the gospel provides to the Church in this present crisis. Dialogue. It is said that it takes the Church at least a century to integrate the experience of an ecumenical council. That means we are just a little more than halfway to integrating Vatican II. The clerical abuse crisis calls us to a revival of the ecclesiology of Vatican II, expressed in the documents Lumen Gentium, the Dogmatic Constitution on the Church, 1964, and Gaudium et Spes, the Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World, 1965. What kind of structures emerge from Lumen Gentium's core model of the Church as the people of God, who share together in a baptismal call to priesthood, prophecy, and government? How many otherwise well-informed Catholics say the Church when they really mean the hierarchy? The imagination that reflexively sees the ordained when it hears the word Church needs to be transformed. Gaudium et Spes begins with the stirring words, marred by the non-inclusive language, the joys and the hopes, the griefs and the anxieties of the men of this age, especially those who are poor or in any way afflicted. These are the joys and hopes, the griefs and anxieties of the followers of Christ. Indeed, nothing genuinely human fails to raise an echo in their hearts. Even more remarkably, Gaudium et Spes affirms, quote, respect and love ought to be extended also to those who think or act differently than we do in social, political, and even religious matters. In fact, the more deeply we come to understand their ways of thinking through such courtesy and love, the more easily we'll be able to enter into dialogue with them, unquote. What marvels of healing might emerge if the Church took seriously the call of Gaudium et Spes to be a dialogue partner in the world rather than a tedious nag? And the call of Gaudium et Spes is not just to hierarchs, but to all of us, to dialogue with people on the opposite side of the political spectrum, as well as the annoying relative across the dining room table. Listening to the Spirit. There are few organizations in the world that have the historical depth and geographical scope of the Catholic Church. Could the Church, with its rich contemplative traditions, join with other institutions in deep listening to the voices and stories of victims of abuse? Can we discern the movement of the Spirit in the Me Too movement, in Black Lives Matter, in movements for Indigenous rights, and in victims' advocacy groups? What an opportunity of grace it would be if the Church, based on such discernment, were to partner with other organizations in researching and implementing best practices of transparency and accountability. The wound to the Church from the clerical sexual abuse crisis has been mortal. The Passion story in the Gospel of John tells us that the body of Jesus was ripped open by the lance of a soldier of the Roman Empire, a regime based on oppression and abuse. But out of that wound flowed blood and water, symbols of baptism and Eucharist, the sources of the life of the Church. Can we believe that facing this grievous wound can result in contemplative action for an unimaginable renewal of the body of the Church and for the healing of the nations? Cosmic Vision. G.K. Chesterton said that the most traditional organizations are also the most democratic because they give a vote even to the dead and are not limited to the oligarchy of people who happen to be walking around. The Church surely has access to the deep wells of renewal in the communion of saints. Theologian Ilya Delio expands that notion by suggesting that the Church should also give a vote to the future. For her, the root meaning of Catholic is not so much universal as whole. She suggests that the Catholicity of the Church refers not to a past perfection to which the Church seeks to be rigidly faithful, but rather to a future wholeness to which the Church, along with all creation, is directed. Can we look to the energies of the evolving cosmos for what they might tell us about church renewal? Perhaps the most important guide for healing from the clerical abuse crisis is the stunning encyclical letter of Pope Francis, Laudato Si. What we have in Laudato Si is astounding. The leader of a religious tradition that helped to form the dominant story of Western patriarchal culture, systematically deconstructing it. The same patriarchal culture that demeaned women and devastated Earth is also responsible for the clerical sex abuse crisis. In Laudato Si, Pope Francis speaks of the sacredness of all that exists, of attention to the smallest things, of listening to the cries of agony of an abused planet, that diversity is a gift, not a threat. Does this not offer a path to healing to a church that has acted as if clerical lives are sacred and the lives of children and vulnerable adults are disposable, that sees the world as a hierarchy rather than the community of mutuality that it is? What the church needs to move forward from this current moment of crisis is people who are not blind to its brokenness, but who are passionate for its mission. That spirit is expressed in a prayer, "I love this church," attributed to Walter Burghardt, S.J. In the course of a half century, I have seen more Christian corruption than you have read of. I have tasted it. I have been reasonably corrupt myself. And yet, I love this church, this living, pulsing, sinning people of God with the crucifying passion. Why? For all the Christian hate, I experience here a community of love. For all the institutional idiocy, I find here a tradition of reason. For all the individual repressions, I breathe here an air of freedom. For all the fear of sex, I discover here the redemption of my body. In an age so inhuman, I touch here tears of compassion. In a world so grim and humorless, I share here rich joy and earthy laughter. In the midst of death, I hear an incomparable stress on life. For all the apparent absence of God, I sense here the real presence of Christ.